We've been in a series for about 9 weeks now about the importance of practices in our lives. And I had a message prepared for today to talk about another practice, but decided to do something totally different because there was another mass shooting, as we all know, last Sunday in a church. And 26 people were killed. And in case we've forgotten, it's not an anomaly. We remember that there have been many mass shootings lately. And Columbine doesn't even make the list anymore. That's how many there have been. And these are just the shootings that make the news, right? Because researchers now identify that a mass shooting is classified as whenever four or more people are shot in one incident, not including the shooter. And when you count them that way, there have been 1,516 mass shootings just since 2013 in our country. On average, that's 9 every 10 days. So the question is why? Why do mass shootings keep happening in our country? And I don't really want to talk about this in church, right? Because we hear about it on the news all the time. And if you're like me, you're tired of hearing about it and you're tired of seeing it. And you want to come to church to escape that, right? To hear good news. So I don't really want to talk about it in church. And I don't want to talk about it here either because it's an emotional issue. And there's all kinds of discussions that take place after any of these mass shootings, and we're emotional, and we all have oftentimes very entrenched positions about this, and sometimes the discussions are thoughtful, and oftentimes they're not so thoughtful. They're almost always political, right? And so for all those reasons, and some of us are already antsy that we're talking about this, I don't really want to talk about it in church. But it's a tough question. Why does this keep happening that we have to wrestle with? And I think all of us are longing for some sort of hope, right? An answer that provides some sort of hope. And here's the reality. If we can't ask tough questions in church, and we can't look for hope here, then what's the point of even gathering? So that's what I want to do this morning, is ask a tough question and maybe look for some hope. And so we're going to take a break from this series on practices. We'll come back to it next week. But today I just want to ask the question, why do mass shootings keep happening? And really there's a broader question here. The broader question is, why is there so much violence? Why is there so much violence in our country? Mass shootings are certainly a large part of that. But if you think about it for a second, most of the people in our country are religious, right? Most of us are educated. Most of us are incredibly well off compared to the rest of the world. We don't have tribes here that are fighting one another. We don't have civil war. I mean, we certainly have ethnic and racial tensions, but we don't have the kind of tribal factions like you see in the Congo or in Sudan where people are slaughtering one another. We don't have any of that. We couldn't have more access to education and beauty and wealth and personal liberties and freedom and economic prosperity. And yet, we continue to have so much violence. Why is that? Well, I want to give you three suggestions. And I want to be honest, there's not great answers to this, but I think it's also not good to say there's no answers. I think there are some answers. So I want to give you three answers this morning, and they're all important. So here's the first one. The reason there's so much mass violence in our country is because we are all inclined toward violence. We're all, every single one of us, inclined toward violence. Now, you may not think so, and I may not think so, and all of us would basically say, no, I would never do something like we see on the news, and I would never kill anyone, and I wouldn't hurt anyone, and I certainly, I have my problems, and I have family disputes, and all those kinds of things, but I would never deal with issues like that in my life by killing people. And at one level, you're right. But at another level, I think we need to admit that we all have an inclination towards violence. If my son is getting beat up by a bully at school, you know what I want to do? I want to teach him to fight back and pay the bully a lesson, right? If we have people who are close to us who are being hurt by others, we want to see the people that are hurting them get hurt. And when our nation is attacked, we want to attack back, right? That's what everyone said on December 7th, 1941. And that's what everyone said on September 11th, 2001. And regardless of how or when you justify certain kind of actions, that's a whole different discussion for another day. The simple point is we all have an inclination towards violence, whether we want to admit it or not. Especially when we get pushed, we want to push and this actually goes way back. It's just a part of the human condition. And I want to unpack this a little bit by reading you a story today from the Bible, from the very, very beginning of the Bible. It comes from the book of Genesis, and it takes place right after Adam and Eve, who most of us know that story. Adam and Eve leave the Garden of Eden, and this is what it says in Genesis chapter 4. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant, and she gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." That's what his name means, to bring forth or to produce. So he has kind of a cool name. Later, she gave birth to his brother, Abel. Abel's name means vapor or puff of smoke. Not so cool, right? Now, Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. So the first question that always arises when we read stories like this is, were these real people? Like, did Adam and Eve really exist? Were they historical, or is this sort of metaphorical or figurative in some way? And we can't answer those today. But here's the most important part. These people represent us. They represent us. In fact, I love what one theologian wrote. His name is Miroslav Volf. He said this about the story. The intention of primal history, and that's what these stories are, these early stories in the beginning of the book of Genesis are primal history. The intention of primal history is to underscore that every human being is potentially Cain and Abel, just as every human being is Adam and Eve. We're all represented by Adam and Eve, and we're all potentially represented by Cain and Abel. So Adam and Eve have these two sons. They seem like they're equals, but not really, right? One is the firstborn, one's the oldest, one has a really cool name, one doesn't, right? And then we see they're different because Cain works the ground. He's into agriculture, so he probably has large fields and he produces food and grain. And Abel watches sheep. That's his vocation. It goes on and says this. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. And so Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. So they both bring offerings to God. This is what they did in ancient culture. It was a way of giving back to God part of what he had given to them. And so they would bring these offerings. Oftentimes they would burn them on an altar. And God accepts Abel's offering. We don't know how this happens or how he says this or makes it clear, but it just happens. He accepts Abel's offering, but not Cain's. And we don't know exactly why, although there are some hints, because it says that Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil. So he brought some of his grain, some of his produce, but Abel brought the first and the best. He brought his firstborn sheep. In other words, he didn't wait till the end of the year to figure out if he had enough sheep to make it for his family and for his business. He took the first ones that were born and gave them to God. He gave his first and his best. And then he trusted that God would take care of the rest. And so maybe there's a peek into both of their hearts here. And as a result, God accepts Abel's offerings, but he doesn't accept Cain. And for the first time, maybe, Cain, the older brother, the Cain, the one with the cool name, the one that's being praised oftentimes, is not praised and not accepted. And it makes him angry. Really angry. And it says, actually, in the Hebrew, that he turns away from God and he looks, instead of looking up, he looks down. Literally, his face fell down. That's that word that we translate downcast here, but downcast in our usage often means someone sad, but that's probably not what it means. It means he turned his face intentionally away from God, and he looked down in his bitterness and in his anger. The story goes on. It says, then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast, or why has it fallen away from my face? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. So God tries to intervene here with Cain. He pleads with him, Cain, you're angry. And you're letting this anger fester. You've looked away from me. You won't even look at me anymore. You're just sort of looking down and inward, and you're letting this bitterness have its way. And I need to warn you, Cain, be careful. You're in a dangerous place. You're about to do something that you're going to regret. You've got to be careful, because if you continue to let this anger fester and stew and this bitterness inside, if you continue to think, well, it's not fair and it's not right and it's unjust that God accepted my brother's offering and not mine, if you continue to think about that and let your emotions get the best of you, be careful, because sin is crouching at your door. It's like sin is like a snake laying there about to tempt you, just like he did your parents. Now, what's interesting is this is the first time the word sin is used in the Bible, and even in the book of Genesis. It's not what we would expect, right? We would expect, if you sort of know your Bible or have been in church for very long, you would expect the word sin to be used to describe what Adam and Eve did in the garden, but it's not used there. Apparently, the writer of Genesis thought the best place to introduce this concept was here, with Cain. And with Abel. And the word sin in Hebrew means missing the mark. It's a picture of an archer who's aiming at a target but misses the target. But it's even not, that's not even perfectly accurate, because that presupposes someone's actually aiming at the target. But the word sin connotes a willful missing. It's as if you're not even aiming at the target. You don't even want to aim at the target. And so there's no excuse when you don't hit the target. Most of us know where the story goes and what happens. Cain doesn't listen to God's warning, and he decides to do something different. Look at how it continues. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel, and he killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? I don't know, he replied. Am I my brother's keeper? Implication is, yeah, you are. So brothers do. They love and they protect and they keep one another. But that's not what you did. You let your anger get the best of you. You let it rule over your heart, and you decided to act out in vengeance and violence to solve your perceived injustice and unfairness. God responds, and look at what he says back to Cain. The Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. And this is actually a phrase that reappears all throughout the Old Testament, because essentially God is saying, I hear the cries of victims of violence. I hear their cries. He's going to say this when the Israelites are in slavery in Egypt. I hear your cries of oppression. God always hears the cries of those who are victimized. So he says, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. But now, remember, he's speaking to Cain. You are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And when you work the ground, and remember, that's his occupation, that's his entire life, working the ground. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you, and you will be a restless wanderer on the earth. In other words, what you did, Cain, not only destroyed your brother's life, it's going to destroy your life as well. And Cain gets this, because look at what he says back to God. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment, or the consequences of my action, my iniquity, is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. And God's not the one hiding him. This means I will hide myself. I'm going to keep not looking at you or toward you. I will hide myself from your presence, and I will be a restless wanderer on the earth. And whoever finds me will kill me. And that's an important statement, because Cain realizes outside of the garden, violence produces more violence. Vengeance is going to become the rule of human life. He realizes people are going to try to kill me because I was the one who killed my brother. People are going to try to make me pay for what I have done. My violence is going to boomerang back to me, and it's going to kill me. And if I was God, you know what I would have said in that moment? You're right, and I told you so. I warned you. I told you this is what would happen. I told you that you would be ruled by this, and this would be your undoing. I told you that. I warned you. And now you are just going to get what you deserve. That's what I would have said if I was God. Because that's my idea of justice. But that's not God's idea. Let's look at what God says to him. But the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." That's not a declaration. That's just a statement, a fact. And then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. And so Cain went out from the Lord's presence, or away from God's face, and lived in the land of Nod. Nod in Hebrew means wandering, east of Eden. Not so, Cain. Not so. I'm going to stop the violence right here. Because see, if someone kills, If you killed your brother, and then someone kills you as a result of that, then someone from their family will probably just kill them, and then someone from their family will kill them, and the violence will just keep continuing, because violence and vengeance always multiply. That's how they work. They feed on one another. But in God's mercy, he chooses on this occasion to stop the cycle of violence and to not give Cain what he really deserved. And so it says he puts this mark on Cain, and we don't know what the mark was. We don't know if it was an actual mark or this is just symbolic or sort of a figurative mark. But he puts a mark on Cain, and this is really important. The mark is not to declare that Cain is a perpetrator of violence. The mark is actually to single out Cain as a possible another victim of violence. That's what the mark serves to do. It prevents Cain from being another victim of violence. The same God who doesn't accept Cain's meager offering decides to extend grace and mercy to a murderer whose life is now in danger of being murdered himself. Now, there's a whole lot going on in the story. And let me bring it back to where we started, because first, as it relates to God, it's really important to see right here in the very beginning of the book of Genesis, we see God regards human life as sacred. All human life is sacred to God. He hears the cries of victims of violence. He mourns their passing. He steps in to even protect a murderer who's about to have violence done to him. It seems in this story at least, right? In this story at least, God is saying, I'm against violence no matter what, whether it's done to the innocent brother or whether it's done to the guilty murderer. But there's another truth here that's important, and it's the truth about you and me, about us as humans. We're all potential Cains. We could all be potential Cains because we'll all face circumstances in life that are unfair, that are unjust, that we think aren't right, and deep within us we'll want to respond out of anger and even violence and force. And it's as if God is saying, don't respond that way. You have to turn to me with your anger. Bring your anger to me. Bring your slights and your unfairness and your injustice. Bring all of that to me, and you and me together will deal with this. But if you just let it stew and fester, you're inclined towards violence. And that's true of the human condition. And you read the rest of the Bible and you see that. We get to Moses, great God, man of God, and he's a murderer. You get the book of Judges, and there's a man named Samson who does all these amazing things, and he's a murderer. You get to David, and he's the greatest king in Israelite history, and he's a murderer. You read the book of Psalms, and so many of his prayers to God are for God to do violence and vengeance to his enemies. You get to Paul, and he's a murderer. You get to the Garden of Gethsemane, where the Roman guards come to take Jesus away, and how does Peter respond? He pulls out his sword to begin doing violence. Peter, who's followed Jesus for 3 years, who's heard Jesus say, we don't hate our enemies like everyone else. We love our enemies. And when someone hits us, we actually turn the other cheek and we expect persecution and we pray for those who persecute us. And my kingdom is going to be different than all the other kingdoms. The other kingdoms, the kingdom of Rome, lives and breathes on violence and power and force. But my kingdom isn't going to be like that. Peter heard that. He experienced that. He knew that. But there in the Garden of Gethsemane, when push comes to shove, what does he do? He pulls out his sword. And the reason is because we're all inclined in that direction to violence. This is what theologians have called part of our sinful nature. We're all inclined towards violence. But I think there's two more factors that I want to touch on this morning when it comes to this issue of mass violence and mass shootings that I think we can't ignore as followers of Jesus. We're not only inclined towards violence, we're encouraged toward violence. Think about how many things in our culture today normalize, desensitize, and sometimes even celebrate violence. Let me give you a few examples. Mixed martial arts, MMA, one of the most, fastest growing popular spectator sports. Some of us pay money to watch two guys beat each other up to a bloody pulp. Do we not think that when that becomes entertainment, that doesn't shape somehow how we think about violence? Think about video games, right, that our kids play, some of our kids and some of us as adults play, and what are the most popular games? First-person shooter games, where you are given a gun or a weapon, and the goal of the game is to kill as many people as you can, as quickly as you can. The newest version of Call of Duty, you might have heard of Call of Duty, they come out with different versions. The newest version just came out last weekend, and the first 3 days sold $500 million worth. And Call of Duty is a game where you are simulating more and more realistically every year the personal killing of hundreds of people as entertainment. Do we not think that's not going to shape how we think about violence? Think about violent movies. Think about horror movies. Think about war movies, right? Which no matter how you frame them, always end up glorifying violence and killing your enemies. The enemies might be Nazis. They could be terrorists. That's beside the point. The message is the same. This is what we do to our enemies. Think about our culture in the military. We have the largest military in the world and the most powerful in all of human history. And there's a reason we have a military, and there's good and noble intentions behind it, and there are so many people who serve bravely and sacrificially. We honored them yesterday, right? My grandfather was a veteran of World War II. My wife's parents served in the Air Force for decades, right? And yet, if we could step back for a second and just think, what do you think it does to millions of people when they're trained to deal with our enemy by killing them? And when our economy is built on producing weapons of mass violence and destruction, which we were the ones that invented in World War II. And maybe you're not even in the military, but many of us work in jobs that are connected to industries that thrive on violence. When war and violence breaks out, it's actually good for business. What do we think that does to how we think about violence? I could give a lot more examples, but I think I've offended almost everyone at this point, right? Especially when you talk about the military. But that's not my goal. And I don't have any easy answers. The answer isn't get rid of the military, right? No, that's not the answer. I'm simply just pointing out how much of our media and entertainment and culture and economy encourages us toward violence. So we're inclined towards it. We're encouraged towards it. But there's one more. We're enabled toward violence. Let me talk about guns for a second. And I know this is touchy, and I'm not going to attempt to be political in any form or fashion. So let me just point out a few facts. This is some research. This is a chart from a researcher at the University of Alabama. Roll Tide. No, sorry. Whew. Take a look at this chart. On the right, horizontal axis shows that we have almost as many guns in this country as people. Civilian guns. This doesn't count military guns. Almost 6 times more than the next country in the world. On the vertical chart, we have 5 times more mass shootings in this country than the next country. On both of these indices, the number of civilian guns and the number of mass shootings, nobody else is even close. Now, if you're like me, you say, well, we're a big country, right? Our population is so much bigger than every other country. I mean, maybe not China and India, but we're bigger than most of the other countries in the world. So let me show you one other chart. Here's the second one. If you look at guns per 100 million people, that's on the horizontal axis. We still have way more guns than anyone else. The next closest are Yemen and Iraq. If you look on the vertical chart, we still have more mass shooters per 100 million people than everyone else except Yemen. Yemen pulls ahead of us. We're second. Afghanistan is third. So these are the 3 countries that are even remotely close to us. Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq, the 3 most dangerous and violent countries in the world. Now, it would be tempting to think this isn't a gun issue, right? And I want to think this is a mental health issue. In fact, I was talking to a friend, and we were talking about this and thinking, like, isn't mental health wrapped up in all this? And that's what some people say, right? But it's not. It's not. We have the same number of mental health cases in this country as other developing countries do. We contribute the same amount of money towards helping people with mental health cases as other developing countries do. And we have the same number of mental health professionals per capita as other developing countries do. But all of those countries have way lower mass violence than we do. There's no correlation between those things. And so the only conclusion that experts can come to is the only correlation between the mass violence in this country is the mass accessibility and availability of guns. And not hunting guns here. This isn't about hunters. Handguns and assault rifles, weapons made exclusively for killing people. And so what do you think it does when we have mass accessibility and availability towards guns? It just enables us to do something we're already encouraged and inclined to do. And so let me be super clear here. The problem is not just guns. The problem is not just guns. It's way bigger than that, right? But guns are still a problem. They enable us towards something we're already encouraged and inclined to do. Because we're all inclined towards violence, we're all encouraged towards it, and we're all enabled toward it. Let me give you an imperfect, sort of silly analogy. You have a friend who has a gambling addiction. He loves to gamble All of his friends gamble, and they fly to Vegas every single weekend to gamble, right? So he's inclined towards gambling in his heart. He's encouraged towards it by all of his friends who influence him, and he's enabled by it by the city that enables all gamblers, right? Las Vegas. So how do you help him stop gambling? Well, you got to address all three, don't you? I mean, if it's me, I think the first thing I'd do is say, look, no more trips to Vegas, right? We got to just cut off the enabling right there. But if that's all you do, he's still going to have influences in his life that encourage him towards gambling, and you haven't even really addressed the heart issue. He still loves to gamble. He will find other ways to gamble. And so you've got to deal with the encouragements and the influences, the things that are shaping this in his life. And then ultimately, you got to deal with the heart issue. He needs counseling. He needs to figure out why he loves to gamble, and he needs Jesus. He needs Jesus because only Jesus can help him overcome this thing that has mastered and ruled his life. So where do you start? Do you start with Jesus and counseling? And then do you replace his friends? And then eventually do you say, okay, now you should probably stop going to Vegas? Like, does it matter where you start? I think you just need to address all three things. And if we want to do something about the mass violence in our culture, I think we'll do the same. I think we'll tell people about Jesus. And we'll say, ultimately, only Jesus can free us from the things that enslave us and can change our hearts and help us deal with the anger and the emotions that can possibly lead to violence. But we won't stop there. We will, as followers of Jesus, think long and hard about the ways that we encourage violence and the ways that we enable it. We'll think long and hard about MMA and video games and the accessibility of guns in our culture. And we'll think about these things not as Republicans and not as Democrats and not as libertarians and not as people who have rights and not even as Americans, right? We'll think about this first and foremost as followers of Jesus, which is where I want to leave us this morning, because Jesus said, you don't kill your enemies. And you don't even hurt them. And yes, there's a place for justice. And yes, there's a place for the government. And yes, there's a place for the police force, right? I mean, Paul was really clear on that. And if your husband is beating you, you call the police, right? But when Jesus talked about this, he said, look, there's all sorts of situations I could address, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to keep it really simple and really clear for people who want to follow me. We love our enemies. And when we love our enemies, this is how we reflect the heart of the Father more than in any other way. You know why? Because that's what he did for you and me when we were his enemies. He loved us. And he went to the cross and he redeemed us and he rescued us from our sin, not through violence and not through force. He could have, right? But he didn't. Peter, put away your sword. Look, Peter, if we want to go that way, we could go that way. I can call on legions and brigades and armies of angels to wipe out all of these Roman soldiers right now. I could bring my kingdom about in that way, but that's not what I've chosen to do. That's not what he chose. He lived and embodied the way that he told us to follow, not by exerting force or doing violence, but by allowing people to exert force and do violence to him. And in doing so, he broke the cycle of violence. And he broke the curse of sin. And he broke the power of death when he died for you and me on Calvary. And that's why we worship a crucified Jesus. And I love what one theologian said to sort of summarize all of this. And this is the last thing. He said this, nonviolence is not a recommendation, an ideal that Jesus suggested we might try to live up to. Rather, nonviolence is constitutive of God's refusal to redeem coercively. Our very redemption on Calvary, what we celebrate every Sunday, is grounded in Jesus' refusal of violence. It's how he saved us. It's how he rescued us from the rule of sin and violence. And it's how he created us to be a community, even today, who would embody that way and bring that message of hope and say, there is hope in a culture of violence. Here's the hope. It's the way of Jesus. This is how he saved us. This is who we are, and this is the message of hope that we have for our world. Let me pray. Father God, so much we could say about such a difficult issue. But I pray that even now, God, you would just remind us of what you did for us on the cross. And your word says that your Son is the exact representation of the Father, and that if we want to know what the Father's like, we just look at the Son. And so this morning we look to Jesus, and we bring all our tough questions, and we bring all of our doubts, and we bring our anger, and we bring our what-ifs, and how does this work in practice, and we bring all of that to you, God. And we just ask you to once again remind us of the redemption and the rescue that you give us, and to help us celebrate who you are and what you did for us at Calvary. I pray this in your name. Amen.